Life. I'm Lina Mirmont, back with my regular program, and it is my distinct pleasure and honor to have my guest today. His name is Professor Daniel Simons. He's a true giant, not only on age of great accomplishments of psychology and psychiatry, but his limitless conceptualizing of our time and our needs as a human beings, his observation, and his final tremendous creation of his book, which called Invisible Guerrilla, will be a subject and a content of our program. Before I will invite to the discussion Dr. Daniel Simons, whom I call either professor or doctor, but it doesn't make much of a difference because his accomplishments just absolutely tremendous. Strictly speaking, I will just introduce his placement in his today's activities. He's a professor of the Department of the Psychology at the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. He also has his president position as a VSCoC Productions, where he is helping with his consultations and his leading thoughts for distribution of DVD, and I understand that he gives the major tools of for this company meaning, and he will talk about that as well. And of course, as I said, the central focal point will be his book with a very intriguing and yet extremely real name. After analyzing this book, we will understand how real name is Invisible Guerrilla. My welcome to Professor Simons, and he allowed me to call him by his first name. So, Daniel, how are you? And I'd like to start our discussion with your entering thoughts.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Well, so, I just interrupting you for just 1 second. I wanted to say that thank you is mine because your, I would say, traffic schedule is so difficult, so overwhelming, that I believe your own life role is incredibly multitask. So I would, with your entering thoughts, to just jump in and tell us what kind of scientific life you have, which relates in everyday living.
Sure. Well, my research field is a field known as visual cognition. So it's the study of how we perceive and focus attention and remember our surroundings, mostly focusing on how we see. And what my book, The Invisible Guerrilla with Chris Chabris, is about is not just how we see, but how we think we see. So we talk about a number of the limitations that we have on our own minds, on how much we see and remember and how confident we are. And then we talk about how our intuitions about those limits are often really wrong. So we tend to think we see a lot more than we actually do. We tend to think our memories that feel really vivid to us are more accurate than they actually are. We tend to feel that we tend to be overly trusting and confident people when confidence isn't always the best predictor of accuracy, and we don't tend to be great judges of our own abilities and tend to be overconfident in those. We tend to think we know more than we do. So all of these are limitations that we have, but the interesting thing about them is not just that we have some limitations on our minds, which at some level isn't terribly surprising. What's interesting is how mistaken we are about those limitations. So that's what I've been studying lately, the ways in which our intuitions about the workings of our own minds are mismatched from the reality of the workings of our own minds.
I like to be somewhat brave a little bit and make immediately some commentary about this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I like to immediately read the very first statement of introduction of your book. It says, reading this book will make you less sure of yourself, and that is a good thing. This is incredibly deceptive at the same time, because why human who is craving for self-confidence and craving for all these positive qualities will continue reading book which has such semi-pessimistic title. However, immediately I will be very presumptuous and I would say that indeed reading your book with endless amount of thoughts, depth, and illustrations makes one feel much more confident, makes intellect much more polished, emotions much more in tune with once and for all, for many, many circumstances. So I would say that it is very truthful, noble statement. And during the course of our program, I hope that my comment, in fact, will be more and more nourished with your knowledge and with your very definite opening of a human possibilities, because without acknowledging our restrictions, we cannot see the progress. So if you semi-agree with what I'm saying, but if you're not, please jump in.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things. A lot of people take the message that we have in our book as a negative one, and I don't think it is at all. So the message is that we have these limitations. And yeah, our book explains what those limitations are, but we have those limitations, all of us do, whether or not we knew about them in the first place. So becoming aware of those limits isn't a negative thing. It allows you to be aware of them and take advantage of them and avoid some of their bad consequences and take advantage of their good consequences. But my feeling is it's always a good thing to know more about how your own mind works. And if we go through life blissfully unaware of the limits of our minds, that can put us in grave danger at times, or it can make us less aware of our surroundings or make us overly confident that we know what we're doing when we don't. And that can lead us to bad things. So I view it as actually a fairly optimistic message that, yes, we have limits on how our mind works. The real problem isn't those limits, because we've had them all along. The real problem is when we don't understand what they are, when we don't know what our limits are. And by becoming aware of those limits, you can actually deal with them in the appropriate sorts of ways.
Absolutely. And of course, there is, as I mentioned, endless qualities, human qualities, which are unfortunately preventing us from looking in depths we deserve to be looked at. And you're talking about attention, perception, memory, reasoning, and how all these tremendous, powerful qualities can be misused. Because indeed, as you said, we think we're right. We think that we see the real thing, but indeed we're not. I think we will try to overcome limitations of the radio, and we will talk about your phenomenal example of invisible gorilla, which is actually in internet and YouTube. And, of course, we will give you an opportunity to give your website and all these points where people can find you. But let's try to describe this phenomenon of people's lack of attention. And that's one point. And the second point, which you made in the book, how people find themselves in shock once they see what they missed.
Sure.
And I'll be very honest with you. I made an experiment with a couple of friends of mine here. And they saw those players, those passings of basketball, and none of them did notice the gorilla. But let's tell the public what I'm talking about, because so far I'm in a mystery here. Could you describe in, well...
Let me go ahead and describe the study.
Yes, please.
So this is a study that Chris Chabria and I did about 12 years ago now when we were both back at Harvard. And we showed people a video, and it was a very simple task. All they had to do was watch this video of people passing basketballs. And there were three people wearing white shirts, and they were passing a basketball. And you just had to count the total number of times they passed the ball. And they made it harder by bouncing sometimes on the floor, sometimes pass it in the air. Sometimes they would fake a pass, and they'd move around each other. So you had to kind of track these players with your mind. Now, we made it even harder by also having three people wearing black shirts passing their own ball, and you only had to count the passes by the players wearing white. Now, you're doing this for about 30 seconds, and then unexpectedly, a person walks into the video wearing a full-body gorilla suit, walks to the center of the scene, stops and faces the camera, thumps its chest, and then walks off the other side of the screen a total of 9 seconds later. And what you find when you ask people afterwards, you ask them things like, okay, how many passes did you count? And they give you some number that's generally pretty close. Then you ask them, did you notice anything other than the players? They say, no. Did you notice anyone other than the players? And they say, no. And you ask them, did you notice a person in a gorilla suit? And they say, a what? And we find that about half the people don't realize that there was a person in a gorilla suit, fully visible right there for 9 seconds. They simply don't see it. And if they've missed it, they often, if we show it to them again, they often don't believe that they're viewing the same video. And people who do see it can't believe that anybody else could possibly have missed it. And the idea is that we have this limitation on how much information we take in. When we're really focusing on something, when our attention is used up focusing it on some aspect of the world around us, we often don't notice unexpected things that happen right in front of our eyes. As long as they're unexpected, we just simply don't see what we're not looking for. And this is a phenomenon that's been known for some years. Our colleague Ulrich Neisser did some studies very similar to these back in the 1970s that were the basis for what we did. We just wanted to make it as visible and dramatic as we could so that if people missed something unexpected like a person in a gorilla suit, they would be forced to confront that intuition they have that 90% of us have, that of course we would notice a person in a gorilla suit. Right? It's something that's so obvious, it's right there. And when you miss it and then you're forced to confront what you've just missed, it forces you to realize that your intuition is wrong. And I think that's why that video has such power. If you show it to your friends and they miss it, it's a really powerful experience. I didn't realize I could miss something that vivid, that big. If you want to try it for yourself, you can go to our book website, theinvisiblegorilla.com. And we've got that video and a bunch of my other videos and Chris's other videos that are similar sorts of demonstrations of what you can see and what you don't see.
It is an absolutely spectacular illustration, and this is only
I hear you now.
Okay, but before it was a little echo. How are we doing now?
Doing good.
Doing good. So this is visual aspect, and we will not go into all this technical perception and reaction of our neurons and so forth. I like to go to our more of a human everyday experiences. And honestly, I like to share my own personal, very modest but habit. If someone tells me about something, having message from the third party, I never will trust the person who verbal a carrier. I like to see myself, the message, and I will feel that at this point I will have much more information from the person who sent it directly to myself. And as I said, I rather to miss my own gorilla than to have someone else to transmit the message and miss his gorilla as well. So when we're talking about transmission of the message, which goes very far, and your book is extremely rich in illustrations of different situations. One of them is, for example, criminal justice, where most detailed and most descriptive elements might determine life or death of the person. So it stretches in absolutely tremendously endless areas of human perception. I'd like to ask you about this story you're talking about, a suicide of the, it's a story where, I'm trying to remember the name of the hero, Wallace, I believe his name.
David Foster Wallace. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is extremely subtle, but again, very powerful, who was prone to suicide, and he and his sister been watching the movie, very sad movie, where I believe Singer did commit a suicide, and he was under such enormous impression. And when his sister said that she is leaving the town, he was extremely upset, and he expressed tremendous sadness. And the reader, in fact, like myself, immediately assumed that the reason this Wallace will have suicidal thoughts is because his sister is deserting him and leaving him without her companionship, when indeed the trigger was the movie. Please comment on this if I understood the concept correctly.
Sure. So the key to that example was actually something we call the illusion of cause. And it's part of a phenomenon. The human mind is fantastic at trying to see the possible causes from one thing to another. So we try and see what caused an action. So in that case, we were describing a story about David Foster Wallace, and the writer of the story, David Foster Wallace was a very famous writer who died some years ago, and this was a compelling narrative describing David Foster Wallace's life and death and the causes of his actions. And what was interesting about the story was that it portrayed a sequence of events, him watching this movie with his sister leaving, him being upset about it, and then him attempting suicide. And the reader of this story will very naturally infer that the reason he attempted suicide was that his sister didn't stay with him. But that was never actually explicitly stated in the story. And one of the interesting things about that is that we're very quick to try and infer the underlying cause, to try and make sense of it by coming up with an underlying cause. And in fact, we remember that underlying cause much better if we come up with it ourselves than if we're told it. And that's what's so remarkable about this case, is that when you think up the cause, when you generate the cause yourself in your own mind, it's a more powerful memory for you. It sticks with you, and you believe that it was actually stated in the story more powerfully. You remember it more effectively. And this is a technique that lots of people use. So this is used by politicians all the time. They leave the actual cause unstated, but imply a cause and allow you, as the listener, to come up with that cause. And when you come up with that cause yourself, you're more likely to believe that it was true. You're more likely to remember it. So it's a technique that takes advantage of how the mind works. If you know that your mind works this way, you can look for those cases where an author, a writer, a politician doesn't state a cause but implies it very heavily, and then realize that, oh, they're taking advantage of this tendency we have to figure out the cause. The solution of cause can also cause us real problems. So we're very effective at picking up patterns, one thing coinciding with another thing. And when one thing comes before another and plausibly could have caused it, the later event, we tend to assume that the earlier one caused the later one. And this can get us into all sorts of trouble, because in many cases, just because one thing preceded another and plausibly could have caused it doesn't necessarily mean that it did.
I cannot wait to jump to one area is a parent and children relationship, because I see tremendous connection there. However, you mentioned pattern, and I wanted to bring a bit of a idea of a statistic. I personally have a great problems with the statistic, because 95% of the people, let's say, will exhibit certain medical symptoms, but then 5% will exhibit something incredibly different, and this 5% can be so different that they can have a new opening in the medical field. So those 5% becoming that unique and that much more promising, let's say, for the next level of a medicine. Yet our statistic, because of the amount, will go in a pattern thinking, whatever is bigger, whatever is major, that means it's right.
Let me comment on that, because I think that's a really interesting point. When I say that we're very good at picking up patterns and thinking, I think what I mean by statistics and what you're referring to as statistics there, talking about groups of people as a statistic, is not what we're talking about. So what we're talking about is what people find most compelling, what persuades them the most. And what persuades people the most is individual stories, anecdotes, personal narratives. The problem comes when those personal narratives aren't representative, when they're not typical, when they're not the core case. So we can be convinced when we shouldn't be. So let me give you a direct example of this so you can kind of get a sense of what I mean. Let's say you're buying a new car, right? And you're trying to decide what kind of car to get, and you look at, say, Consumer Reports and look at all of their ratings, and you find that Toyotas and Hondas are the most reliable cars. So you're all set to go buy a new Toyota, and your Uncle Louie tells you, oh, well, I had a Toyota once, and it was always in the shop. We're going to be unduly influenced by our Uncle Louie, when what we really should be paying attention to are the reports of over 100,000 people who've owned all these different cars and are reporting on their reliability. We're very persuaded by those individual stories even when those individual stories may not be typical, may not be the case that we really care about, when what we should rely on are the statistics, but our minds just are not built for those sorts of statistics. Our minds were developed and formed over, you know, millennia when we didn't have huge databases of numbers to look at, or huge experiments, or Google. We couldn't search for databases of information. Consumer Reports didn't exist when we were trying to decide which plant to eat when we were hunter-gatherers. The consequence of that is we rely instead on anecdotes, stories from friends, stories from family, which were the best evidence we had for millennia. But now we actually have tools to see which of those things are actually important and which ones aren't, and they're relatively modern tools. The scientific method really hasn't been along for that long. So the key is that our mind isn't really built to use rates of things happening or statistics or the probabilities of something happening. Instead, we're built to use anecdotes, but that can get us into trouble when those anecdotes aren't all that accurate.
You also made a point of, just related to what you said, that our mind remembers consecutively expressed facts easier, and that's what mine is craving for. But when it comes to the story, which you just mentioned, an anecdote, we go only as far as being entertained.
Well, I think we can do more than going for. I think we can do a lot more than just being entertained, right? So, when we think about evidence, the evidence that we use to make our judgments, to come to the beliefs that we have, we tend to be influenced more by those sorts of stories. They're memorable. When I teach, when I'm lecturing to a group of students, the most memorable things I can do are demonstrations where people kind of get the story. They have a mystery that's solved for them. I could list facts throughout a class period and nobody would remember any of it because it's boring. But if you put it in the context of a story, people remember the story and they remember the facts along with it. So if you give people a sequence of events that tie together a whole bunch of facts, they're much more likely to remember those facts than they are if you just give them the facts themselves.
Yes, absolutely correct. So it has to be dressing to just a dry fact. I'll bring one example, and I like to shift into idea of focus. I think it's extraordinarily important, and your numerous examples, even just to read your content titles, which are quite intriguing. But coming back to my point regarding the focus, I will give you one example, which is quite incredible. There used to be an extremely well-known legend, a violin teacher. He never showed anything on violin playing himself. He only talked about the principles and only talked how music of violin should be performed. He had one of the best in the world, I should say, without any stretching of imagination, results of such an approach, such a method. And many years people doubt him, but then when results spoke for itself, it became very evident that his speech and, of course, use of a language was such incredible focus that not only it was not necessary for him to illustrate the playing of violin, but I believe now going further on my own, he didn't want to dilute his message by playing instrument himself, because after all, it could be all bunch of other messages, visual, emotional, etc. So would you comment on, in terms of focus, what are the components which person feel particularly vulnerable, and how we can strengthen our perception to increase our focus?
Well, I think there are a couple of interesting points from the story you just described, the violin teacher. One of the things that's very hard about teaching, of course, is to be able to put yourself into the mindset of a student. And we all tend to make this mistake, what's known in the training literature as the curse of knowledge. If you know too much, and it makes it very hard to imagine what life would be like if you didn't know that. So if you're an expert violinist and you're trying to teach somebody who's never played violin before, it's very hard to put yourself back into the mindset of somebody who's never played violin before, which leads to a lot of bad violin teachers, for example, just saying, showing the student and just playing something and saying, okay, do that. And the student has no idea what they're supposed to do because it's too complicated. It involves too many elements. But a really good teacher is going to be able to simplify and know how to explain just the element that that student is ready to understand so that they can kind of build on their knowledge. So I think that's a really nice example, because what great coaches and great teachers can do is present the information in a way that's restricted, that's limited, so that the student can focus on just what they have to. I often like to use the example of learning to drive. You know, when you're first learning to drive a car, everything matters. You have to remember which foot you're supposed to press the accelerator with, which pedal is the accelerator. You have to both hands on the wheel. You're constantly worried about how fast you're going and how hard you have to press the accelerator to know how fast you're going. You're worried about where you're supposed to be looking and how much to turn the wheel in order to turn. And all of those things are really attention demanding. And as you're learning to drive, it takes a while for them to become more automatic. They take all of your effort, and you couldn't focus on anything else. But eventually, some of those things become practiced, and then you're ready to take on more subtle skills, like thinking about, you know, when to pass, or thinking about whether you're going to make it through a red light or not. Those sorts of things take a different kind of focus, but you can't really concentrate on one thing until you've practiced and learned the other ones. And I think that's what a great violin teacher would be able to do, is to point out what are the subtle things you need to do first before you can do the more complicated, sophisticated things. But more generally, I think you're asking about the idea of focus and what we can do to increase our focus or to allow us to take in more information. And I think what's interesting about that question is, if most people ask me that in the context of, say, the gorilla video that I described earlier, is there something you could do to take in and see, make sure that you would see the gorilla? And I think that's not really the right question, because there are limits on our mind, right? There are only so many things we can take in at a time, and if we could take in everything, we'd be in real trouble, because we wouldn't be able to focus on the things that actually matter. So if you weren't able to keep focusing on the things you care about and filtering out the distractions around you, then you'd be perpetually distracted. You'd be perpetually looking away from what you were trying to do. It's just a consequence of that really effective and important filtering that we can do that we sometimes don't notice what we're not looking for.
It is absolutely a comprehensive answer. And I, as I mentioned before, I'm dying to jump into extremely relevant issue is a connection between parent and the children. Also, I think logically will connect to instruction between the teacher and the children. However, I like to honor our guest again by thanking him that he agreed to participate in this program. Such relevant subject in our highly stressed, digital minded, emotionally tuned times. And here we have this very genuine, profound, eloquent, extremely useful and progressive way of thinking and practical demonstration. I have to say that the gorilla became my best friend. I like to give you just a little moment of rest. I like for us all to reflect on this moment of focus on our life and our challenges using this a little focus on very brief interlude with the music written by Julian Lampert. Well, with this amazing grace improvisation of Julian Lampert, we're coming back to my very special guest, Professor Daniel Simons, and we're discussing the anatomy of a vision of the world, of our illusions, and something which we're living every day, every moment, and something which we, in some point, overusing in the wrong way, but in some point we can improve, we can focus, we can polish, and profit in our professions or in everyday life. I wanted to ask you a certain position where relationship can profit tremendously from this more in tune and more subtle communication between, for example, parents and the children. Because there is a sense of a stereotype, I think, can be very damaging. In fact, you have one example in a book which does not necessarily correlate exactly with what I'm talking about, but very close. A girl was delivered into the emergency room with a very strong cough, and a doctor assumed that she has the asthma attack because all science and his experience and all this pattern of thinking was present there. However, that not necessarily could be the case all the time. So if we will talk about some emotional human messages there, I believe that if parent will be more observant, more patient, and more sensitive to idiosyncrasies of their children, it will be that much more communication, especially because children are not so good to express themselves verbally often. Your points on that?
Sure. Yeah, well, let me comment on that example that you were just giving. And it's actually, I think, an example that somewhat goes the opposite direction from the way you were leaning, so which is interesting. The example was a person coming into the emergency room, and they have a cough. They're having trouble breathing, and what a doctor with a lot of expertise will want to diagnose first are the things that are the most likely. So you wouldn't want to go into the emergency room and have a doctor, if you went into the emergency room with a cough, you wouldn't want the doctor to initially assume that you had some really bizarre tropical disease that's only found in one tiny part of the world where you've never been, right? Because the odds of that are so low that it wouldn't be terribly useful diagnosis. If you come into the emergency room with a cough, the cause could be thousands of different problems. But what you want them to focus on first are the ones that are the most likely so that they can treat those and rule them out. And if they can't do that, if they can rule out the simple ones, they're going to gradually try to rule out the more and more rare ones until they can find one that's likely to be the cause. In this particular case, the first thing you should assume if somebody's coming into the ER and they're having trouble breathing is they're having an asthma attack, because if they're doing that, the treatment is immediate. It's the most likely case, most likely cause. In this particular case, it wasn't that. It wasn't asthma, so they tried to figure out what it was, and nothing showed up on the x-rays for something caught in the throat, which would be the next guess. And it turned out that the reason they couldn't find anything caught in the throat was that the thing that the child had swallowed didn't show up on x-rays. So it was a really rare, odd effect, odd cause. But you want them to rule out the ones that are the obvious ones first, and that's a really good thing to do. And what experts learn to do is to prioritize the things that are likely to happen first and not to focus on the really rare likelihoods first. So it was an example of expertise. But let me come back to your issue of parents and understanding their children and thinking about what their children are trying to say. And I think there are a couple of these sorts of illusions we talk about in the book, The Invisible Gorilla, that address cases of people miscommunicating and not really listening to what their partner or their child is saying. And I think the most common one has to do with the illusion of memory. And this all springs from the belief we have that when we recall something really, really vividly and in a lot of detail, it feels like we're playing back a perfect recording of what had happened to us. But the reality is that that vividness, just because it feels really rich and detailed, doesn't mean that it's any more accurate than any other memory. And our memories, much of the time, are systematically wrong. So what that means is if you think you're recalling something perfectly accurately and you're having an argument with your child or your spouse about who recalls something better, you're likely both wrong, but you've got to realize that your own memory, even though it feels right, might not be. So let me give you a personal example of this, and this is something that I really advise you to try for yourself just so you can kind of experience the result. Think back to some really vivid event for you. It could be a personal event or a national event. So for our book, I recalled what I was doing and how I heard about the attacks on September 11th. So where I was, what I was doing. I recalled being in my lab at Harvard with my three students, all of whom were named Steve. And I was in my office, and somebody from another room yelled about something had happened. We tried to find out on the Internet what was going on. We were listening to the radio. We watched it on television afterwards. Then I went to pick up my wife and took her home, and I had a lot of detailed memories of what had happened. And it really felt like I was playing back a video recording of my experience. It was that vivid and that emotional. So I wrote everything down that I remembered in as much detail as I could. And then I emailed all of the people I remembered having been there and asked each of them to write out their own memory of how they heard and what they were doing and who they were with without telling them anything about what I remembered. And it turns out that two of the people I remembered being there with me weren't, had pretty good evidence that they were nowhere near there. I didn't remember, as it turned out, the person who was actually in the room with me at the time I heard about it. So really fundamental details were wrong, but my memory still felt vivid. I felt like those records weren't right, but that what I remembered was right. And that's the powerful effect we have, that when we recall something vividly, we're really hard-pressed to realize that it might not be right. So when you're talking with your child or having an argument with your child about who remembered something or what happened, and you both are relying on your own memories and both of you are going to feel like your memory is right, it's really important to realize that that belief that you're right could well be an illusion, that our memories aren't as accurate as we think they are. And that if you're arguing over something that is just a matter of who remembers it right, it's not worth having that argument, because unless there's some way of verifying, it's not, there's no way to prove it right, and everybody's just going to be upset about it.
I certainly like to extend a little bit with my own beliefs. I think with the depths of communication, and you made a very clear point, because if conversation just so shallow about basically say who is right, who is wrong, it's a one thing. But if we will bring a little deeper communication, when abstract communicates with the concrete and concrete nourishing as the abstract, that I believe would be an ideal communication between adult and a child. Children, just by nature, is much more resourceful in fantasies and this, I do not want to say false perception, not at all, but their imagination by definition is so much deeper and so much more resourceful, and gradually they're going through this project, finding more and more invisible gorillas, and hopefully transformation will be such that they will be comfortably balanced in the real world, and yet their creative and personal gifts. So this is, I'm creating just a perfect diagram. But if take this situation of what we remember, I cannot imagine a better example. You're not particularly talking about this in your book, but you have such incredible amount of subtle examples, and the way you're describing this, by the way, is so detailed. Yes, there are some wonderful fancy terminology, which I cannot fit in one program, hopefully. It's not the last program. But if we're coming back just to everyday life, which is just as complex as some of your samples there, I would say that being on stage and that stage fright and stage presentation cannot profit more from these illusionary fears, illusionary things which simply don't exist. I'm not talking about even conquering your ego and some other fear things, but if an artist, absolute genius, comes on stage and after this experience, someone asks him, what was your experience of your interpretation or your emotional state? It will be sometimes the person would not even remember the whole thing. He would say or she would say, I just was so nervous, I don't remember what it was. And it's actually a healthy reaction. because if all this fear will be remembered, it might be the last performance. So let's talk about a couple of particularly emotional issues and how we can remedy this with your analysis and your understanding. Let's say about fear and joy, those two opposites.
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting question. And I think you're right. It's not something we talk about a whole lot in the book. And in part, that's because the kinds of things we're focusing on are what we think of as everyday illusions, are cases in which we're thinking about how our cognitive processes work, how our thinking and reasoning and memory sorts of processes work, and not so much about our emotions or preferences or what we find joyful or fear-inducing. I think part of the reason for that is one of the arguments we're making in this book is that our intuitions are wrong in many cases about how our mind works. But we don't really necessarily, our emotions and our fears and our preferences aren't really going to benefit tremendously from deliberate, careful, thorough thinking and analysis. In many ways, those are kind of gut intuitions that aren't going to be any improved by thinking about them more carefully. Now, there are cases when they are, like phobias, for example, like you were describing the fear of being on stage. Phobias are something you can deal with by getting the right kinds of therapy, which often involve experiencing the effects again and showing that, forcing yourself to realize that there aren't bad consequences to them. So somebody who's afraid of spiders, if they're exposed to spiders and forced to confront that fear, often that can help eliminate it. Working through what exactly induces stage fright is something that you can kind of work through with the right kinds of exposure and right kinds of experiences. But that's very much different than thinking about it a lot more. And it's not clear that thinking about it is going to help. In contrast, thinking about how your memory system works actually can help you overcome some of those mistakes and illusions you have about how your memory works. So I'm not sure that I really have all that much to say from the perspective that we write about things like joy and fear.
Well, but still you expressed a lot and to...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Lena. We've lost you.
A little bit...
Now it's better.
Now it's better too, yes. Well, since unfortunately time is running faster than desire to conclude this program, I cannot finish this program without talking about our last subject, which is only one of many, many subjects in your book, is the magic genius of Mozart. It is certainly well-known fact that in 1993, and you mentioned about this, Mr. Gordon Shaw actually demonstrated that this mathematical structure of classical pieces somehow relates to neurons of our brain. You will say it much, much better than I am.
But hypothesized that it did. That was a theory that really does not have any empirical support at this point.
Okay, but there is another theory which does, and you have an example in your book when the sport coach asked to play very loudly Mozart, either symphony or whatever composition that was, in order to influence state of mind and perhaps emotions of sport people.
Let me give a little background on this. So this was a claim from the early 1990s that listening to about 10 minutes of a Mozart piano concerto would lead to an increase in intelligence, in IQ. And it was a paper that was originally published in the journal Nature, which is one of the top journals in all of science. The problem was that nobody else could replicate that result. So the result was published, and it was a pretty dramatic claim that just listening to 10 minutes of music would actually increase your intelligence. It became known as the Mozart effect, and it got a tremendous amount of publicity. It's still something that a lot of people believe today, even though there have been a number of failures to replicate the effect. So science doesn't bear out this result. What does seem to be the case is that under some conditions, listening to Mozart is more pleasant than sitting in silence and not doing anything. So it puts you in a better mood, and you can actually do the task a little bit better. But it has nothing to do with actually changing your IQ or causing things to resonate in your brain. it's just a case of putting yourself in a positive mood makes you do a little bit better on a task. What's interesting about that effect is how pervasively it became known. So much so that professional football coaches were piping Mozart music into their fields when people were playing, and Zell Miller, when he was governor of Georgia, gave a Mozart tape or classical music tape to all newborn babies, parents of all newborn babies in the state of Georgia on taxpayer dime. All of these sorts of things were based on this premise that listening to Mozart would increase your IQ, would make you smarter, and there's absolutely no evidence for that at this point. It's one of these illusions, and it's the illusion that we call the illusion of untapped potential. And it's this idea that we all have this amazing potential that can be released with just a very simple thing, like listening to 10 minutes of music. We do all have amazing potential, but in order to reveal that potential, it takes work, it takes effort, it takes practice. You don't become an expert chess player overnight just by listening to 10 minutes of music. You have to spend years studying. And I think that's where the danger comes in. If you feel like you're going to release your untapped talents with a very simple manipulation, something very simple that takes no effort, that's probably, you know, too good to be true.
Absolutely. I like to, however, squeeze one thing, I hope I will make my point. There is a tremendous intuition in a positive sense. If one knows him or herself well enough and knows what can support his or her either professional work at the very moment or just general style of life, can choose indeed piece of Mozart, which can be so elevating, can be so incredibly escalating in a positive power of emotions, that it, indeed it can increase productivity. It can bring a tremendous result. However, it should be much more a connection between the source and a choice. And what you were demonstrating and explained that this sport people, of course, it sounds terribly disconnected. And I think this coach was very desperate to get some kind of a cognitive improvement, and he decided to reach as far as Mozart.
Let me just comment on that briefly. I'm not saying that listening to Mozart is a bad thing. Listening to Mozart is wonderful. I'm a huge fan of Mozart, and if listening to music can put you in a positive mood, can put you in a good state, those are all good things. What we need to be careful about is thinking that listening to Mozart is going to radically change our brain. It might help you perform better. Sure, if it relaxes you or it gets you in the right mental state, that's great. But it's not fundamentally changing how your mind works. It's just changing what you happen to be able to do at that moment.
Absolutely.
And that's a good thing, too.
Absolutely. Exactly. It's a good thing, too. Exactly. You cannot make any kind of a primitive conclusion and to take as a Mozart as a immediate quick fix pill and expect that your brain will become like Mozart. Absolutely. My quick last conclusion is that the more connections we make, the more promise there is to sharpen our perception. I believe that we should not be afraid to be wrong, and we learn creatively how wrong you were and how one can be humorous about this, and how one can be very serious about this. And I wanted personally to thank you, because in a very scientific in one sense and human way in another sense, you combine this incredible message. I think it's a tremendous excitement, promise, and tremendous discovery of endless power of human brain. So I, for remaining moments, I just wanted to thank you so much. If your time and desire permits, we'd like to have another discussion on this. But in the very last moment, if you can tell us where you, how we can find you again.
Well, the easiest way to find me is on our website for our book, which is www.theinvisiblegorilla.com. And there are links to other information there, videos. You can also just go to my own website, which is dansimons.com. And there's more information there. So both of those places are the best way to reach me.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
in life.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.